This is After Dark, X Spaces version. We will in an hour have Angel will be hosting one on YouTube as well, a little slight different format. But we wanted to make sure we were able to kind of reach the Spaces community and be able to invite people up to speak and have discussions. The format itself is going to be each week we'll have a theme, and I'm going to try to make a theme somewhat tied to the last episode and some aspect of that if possible. And so we'll go over the theme, and we'll have invited speakers, and then we'll get into more of an AMA where anyone can come in and ask questions, everything from TTRPG, story world development, to production of the stream itself, to voice acting tricks and things of that. You know, we have a few voice actors in the cast that can help answer questions around that, and anything actually in the actual play and TTRB space. So we'll cover a whole slew of topics on the AMA side, and then we'll have themed ones in the future. So that's kind of the general gist of it. And so with that, we're going to go ahead and start off with the theme of the day. And as you can see in the title, we really want to understand, and Angel here, by the way, is not only my co-host, my co-founder, my sword brother, and a slew of other titles, but also a very long-term, really close, dear friend, blood brother of mine. And why don't you go ahead, Angel, and talk a little bit about kind of who you are and your background and briefly, and then we can get started on the theme of the day.
Sure. Apologies for the being a bit underwater. I'll have to look at that when I have more time and space. So welcome. I'm Angel. I'm the GM for Darkport. I've been, I guess, also the chief creative officer for whatever that's worth. And I've been GMing for almost 40 years now. It's been an interesting run. I'm also a writer, and I love storytelling. I love narratives. I love playing with plot and characters, and especially now these days themes. And I wanted to do something. I'm always looking to do something that I've never done before. Always, always, always. So when we started this campaign, I wanted to, a different story, and I've told it at different places, but this is not the campaign I thought I was going to be running. But once I realized that, oh, okay, this is going to be a war story, I really wanted to delve into that. And part of telling a proper war story is, of course, that you're going to have these huge combats. And let me tell you, if you're familiar with this edition of D&D, or really any edition of D&D that's not all the way back to its wargaming roots, which it does have, trying to run large-scale combat is pretty monstrous. So current combat they're in is about 60v6, actually a little bit more even on the enemy side, that they started about 65 that they started with on the enemy side. And it has taken us, let's see, Corey, about five hours of actual playtime to this point.
Yeah, you're trumping a little bit of my questions. It's okay. But yes, okay. It has. And by the way, Fear, thanks for joining. Feel free to raise your hand and definitely come up if you want to speak or ask any questions. This first part is going to really, we're getting the expertise of Angel here, who is now, and has been for a long time, GMing, both homebrew as well as live stream games. And we're covering the topic of how to manage live scale. So, Angel, what I really kind of wanted to do, and you can cover this in different slices and dices, but what are the differences? And we can get into prep versus actual, like during the actual game session. But what are the differences that between homebrew and live stream in terms of, let's say, to start off with preparing for such an event? Because as I know, and I experienced downstairs, there's a lot of things that are different as far as I can tell.
Oh, okay. So preparing, got it. So for a home game where it's just for the enjoyment of you and your, friends and family, which was been a great preponderance of my career, that does vary. It depends on the game. It depends on what you're trying to do. But for me, I would say probably in the last, 10 years, I really approach it as, excuse me, really approach it as trying to bring a living, breathing, coherent world alive to life. So I don't necessarily, there's some like traditional prep, jam prep that goes on, where you want to make sure you have an agenda for the session. You want to make sure that you know what all your, you know, any, if there's going to be combat, you want to have your arms around the numbers on that, because you never want that to get in the way of the narrative or get in the way of the storytelling as you're kind of fumbling around. And to be frank, I mean, that's something I'm still, to be transparent, that's something I'm still kind of dealing with in fifth edition, because this is not the edition that I grew up with, you know. D&D is not even, oh, go ahead.
Do you want to talk about I think some people would be beneficial to understand kind of how you make decisions on rolling hit points for characters. Do you roll everyone up individually? Is it only like the primary characters? I think some of that prep would be very interested in some people that are GMs that want to understand how to prepare.
Sure. I'll circle back around to that. Just remind me if I forget it, but, and then I would say that the non-traditional stuff that I'm doing to prepare is, really thinking about like, really thinking about how the world is going to come to life and what are the forces that are at work, even as you're focusing in, right? You're really drilling down on this one part of what should be a huge, pretty large tapestry. Of a campaign, and you're like animating that for that session for those 3, 4, 5 hours or whatever it is, everything else is still going on in the world. And if you as the GM understand that and you can hold that and you can conceptualize that and have that running, then even as the players are playing things out, it's not like you're just in a reality bubble and the only thing that's happening in the world is happening on screen. You know, 99.99% of things that are happening off screen, which may sound like weird narratively, but once you get used to it and once you get used to thinking about it that way, essentially closer to real life, it gets easier and easier, and it becomes, I wouldn't want to do it any other way. So a lot of the prep, Corey, is about understanding what other gears are turning and what other machinations are going on with all the other NPCs. And then also, and this is really important so that your players don't get swallowed up in a vast world, what effects their actions from previous sessions have had, and as those continue to ripple out and kind of ping pong around.
That's a great point you add a whole other layer, which is around kind of the world doesn't stop, even though we're not focused on that in any game session, and that may have ripple effects. Yeah. So that's really cool to have that.
It's critical. Thank you. No, I would say it's a, you know, I'm not obviously not unique in this way, but I would say it's definitely a hallmark of my campaigns. I would say if there were two things that were like important about this, you know, important about my GMing style, are having a rich, deep, and fully activated world. And then the other one would be like giving things a psychological heft that I don't see in a lot of games. And then in terms of like the mechanical prepping, so for large scale battles specifically, yes, we're talking large scale. I'd say two main kind of tricks that I use to speed things along. So if you know that, like, for example, and this has happened twice now with y'all, and especially in that first battle, which was about, there were five of you then, there were probably about 45 of them. And I knew that fully 2/3 of the enemy force was going to be archers. I mean, they were just going to be raining down. So you do not wait, just mechanically, you're not going to wait to roll that out. You roll that all out ahead of time. And then if you start, if for whatever reason you haven't rolled out enough, you can just start kind of retreading on, you know, you can go back to the top of the queue and kind of run through the numbers again. I tend to roll, I'm, you know, a bit of an over-preparer, so I tend to roll more than I think I'm going to need. Also roll damage if there are hits there ahead of time. And one trick, Justin does this, actually, I haven't really enforced this at the table, but one trick that some players use is to roll to hit and damage at the same time. It's a slight thing, but like multiply it over you know, a gazillion combat rounds, it kind of matters. And then the other thing I would say, because Corey, there are going to be battles in this campaign that are just not scalable for what we're doing currently, you know, where it's like one mini is one person. I've been thinking about this too, about how to do, like, you know, when you fight a legion, because that's 5,000 people, and obviously you can't fight them directly. So there's going to be a lot of hit and run, and there's going to be a lot of, but at the same time, you're not fighting all 5,000 people simultaneously either. So at that point, you're probably looking at breaking it down more into discrete scenes that are still in the narrative. They're still happening within the context of, we're trying to, you know, harry 5,000 people and whittle them down as they get march closer and closer to our home.
And do you kind of like have them grouped in platoons or groups? So you're like, okay, this scene, this group is kind of the one that activated, and therefore I know what that looks like versus, say, an elite Royal Guard. I don't know. You tell me a little bit about kind of the mindset of, we have 5,000 and you have these skirmishes, right? These hit and run skirmishes.
It's going to be hit and run. There are going to be some skirmishes. A lot of it though depends honestly on the enemy. So, you know, at the very beginning of this campaign, I told you that the enemy was not stupid and that they were, you know, that they were not weak. So it really depends on, like, who the enemy general is that's running, I guess, Leggett in y'all's case. But, you know, who the enemy leader is, what they're doing, how they have their groups organized. And that kind of, like, understanding of who you're going up against is critical in success. So you want somebody who's incompetent. You want somebody who doesn't trice up the line, you know, where, so to speak, where, you know, the soldiers or the legionaries are kind of wandering around, and you want lax nighttime security. You don't want them in effective fighting forces. You want them in mobs. You want them disorganized. You want them disgruntled at being pulled away from their home, all of those things. And then, yeah, for sure, like, fighting elites is a very different thing. But you're probably never going to have, like, thousands of elites. And if you do, you're screwed. Like, that's still a battle, even if there are 100 of them.
Three swords come to town, huh?
Yeah, I'd probably be willing to run that. Like, I would say anything 100 and under, I'd probably be just willing to run as is and, like, really pre-roll that stuff. And when they're hitting you, instead of rolling for, you know, probably take averages at that point, or, you know, plus or minus, you know, like, first hits average, second hits 1 point down, second hits 1 point up, and just do it that way. Like, really, really speed it up too.
So following that, I mean, how do you balance, or I know this may be a constant experiment since live stream is relatively, you know, we're one a little over 1 year into it now. How much combat you do on screen, how many sessions do we take to get through this versus how much you kind of pre-roll, especially like the armies are maybe fighting the citizens off screen. So I think it'd be really good to understand at least your current mindset on that.
So those are two different that's a really good question. That's kind of two different questions in one. So one is about pacing and one is about the the actual mechanics of dealing with it. And this goes back to, like, preparing for a streaming game versus a home game. Because, of course, in a streaming game, you have things like terrain and you have things like models and you have things like, the Candle of Tales, and you have to, like, which we use, which is an actual physical prop. Like, there's a whole bunch of stuff that there's basically a supply chain. Honestly, there's a supply chain and that is not there for a home game. I mean, you grab a die and it's like, nope, there's your character. But in terms of pacing the game, that is a good question. I tend to run at a more stately pace. I like to have nuance. I like to have psychological depth. Having characters in battle who you don't know and you don't care about is meaningless. So I will go much, much longer, as you know, than I think any other streaming. I haven't seen a whole bunch of streamers, but I've seen, I don't know, I've probably watched 2-3 dozen now different campaigns to different degrees, you know, some a episode or two, some of them quite a bit of time. And we have gone the longest out of anybody that I've seen without having a combat. I think there was one stretch in there where we didn't have a combat for like 5 episodes when we were getting ready to go.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, but I mean, it makes it a little special in some ways that we spent a lot of that time.
It does. And it also like means that combat is not, violence is not necessarily something that it's not your go-to. And it's like in D&D, you know, it's assumed because it is a fantasy game. Although I would say this campaign is pretty solidly into the dark fantasy, bandwidth of that spectrum. It's just kind of assumed that you're going to have a lot of combat, but I think of it more like, well, if you know, like in Vampires the Masquerade, like if there's combat, something has broken down. Something has not gone quite right. Now, this is a war story, so you're going to have combat, but like you have to be, it's not the same thing as the political, you know, purely political game. But you want to avoid unnecessary risks. And then, you know, really calculate out, and you do a really good job, like, you know, running numbers and like, you really get it. It is a numbers game. Like it really is a numbers game at the end of the day. Especially when you're fighting that many people. So that was on the pacing piece. And then what was the other part that, you were asking about, Corey?
Yeah. So there's the pacing piece. And then it's just kind of, like I said, just, I'd be curious how much people like to see it on stream. Go ahead.
Who is, and then I think there was like a question of, which pieces of the enemy were activated and like that. So you have to keep, you know, audience interest, but I think the people who are following the story, actually I know this from the DMs and from talking with people in real life that, they're on board for this kind of relatively rare combat, relatively slow pace, not glacial though. I mean, things happen every single episode. I don't believe in filler episodes. That's the other flip side of it. Like everything, part of my training as a writer is that everything has to have a reason. Every single scene has to have a reason. Otherwise you cut it. Otherwise you don't have it. Every character has to have some kind of purpose, even if it's just atmosphere, or you cut them, you don't have them. So I think we're in a pretty good place. And, you know, there's of course an ongoing discussion about, what has broader appeal and all of that and how much we want to lean into that. But I think we're more than a year into this, just over a year into this. I think we're in a pretty good place with that. You know, I do.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I was thinking about Game of Thrones and how often they have combats versus really it's about moving the story along. And sometimes it's a single killing, a secret killing, a poisoning, you know, when Arya finally gets her revenge, you know, later down the line.
Right.
These sort of different things that are just, I think they're really good for monumental, like, you know, epic arc events that happen that don't have to be necessarily full combat. They could just be these subtle little wins that maybe no one even really knows about in some cases.
No, it's true. To that point, one of the most consequential combats in fantasy, if not in historical, you know, historically speaking, are personal duels. And I've actually been thinking about that. We haven't really had a good one-on-one or two-on-two duel yet. So I'm kind of looking at that, and I can see some possibilities, but, you know, obviously this isn't scripted, so it all depends on, it'd be easier if it was.
Yeah. Also, that makes a lot,
you know, also much more boring. For me and probably for the people watching it, because no matter how creative you are, you're never gonna be more creative than the wonderful chaotic mess that is, you know, glorious chaotic mess that is tabletop role playing and what emerges from like from a talented, engaged table. I mean, it's just you can't write this stuff.
Nope, you're not mind readers, and you can't really, you know, I mean, we're not like practicing these things, you know, offline 24/7 going with all these scenarios. It's just, you know, we have a little bit of an idea of what our skill sets and capabilities are, but we're all reacting to real-time situations, and we we don't definitely don't know what the enemy is going to be doing, and you don't even know what the enemy's going to be doing until we do stuff to kind of react to it as well. So until it's kind of interesting. It's a dance. Yeah.
And that goes back to kind of like, you really have to GM, you really, really need to know these enemies. You really need to understand their psychology. You need to understand their weaknesses. You need to understand their, not only their goals, but also their fears. They all have their weird, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect person, and they all have their weird little issues, as do the characters, you know. And it's, I know sometimes it's frustrating. You're a senior enough player, and you've also been through Masquerade before, where you're not always fully and perfectly in control of your character. Like we
grew up with that.
You know, we grew up with that, like with the idea that you're having to battle these things inside of you. For you know, those of you who haven't ever played Masquerade before, it's Vampire the Masquerade. It's like a centerpiece of the game is that as a vampire, you're playing a vampire, and as that, you have the beast inside of you, which is constantly trying to get you to kill people or to eat other vampires or, you know, lash out, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just like, it's a constant lurking presence in the game. And I was really thinking about an interaction that we had toward the very end. And I think it's, there was a back and forth between me and Toby, and I really saw it. You know, Toby's an incredibly good player. I love Toby. Officiated his wedding, you know, kind of fond of the guy. Introduced him to his wife, who's also a dear friend of mine. His future wife, who's also a dear friend of mine, who will also be playing in Curse of Strahd.
Yeah.
It's a tight group. But there was a moment where he was like, WTF, mate, you know, when I kind of imposed something on his character, because his character essentially is a beast. I mean, it's not exactly the same. It doesn't, you know, he's not craving blood all the time to drink, but he is kind of craving blood, because that draconic blood is strong.
I thought that was very appropriate. It's just experience, and Toby likes to be in control and knowing what his character can and can't do. And well, when he's surprised it like that, we all do.
Just to acknowledge, not necessarily quote unquote to defend him, but just like you and I come, this is a whole different discussion, but like you and I come from a different era, Corey. And the current era, you know, you could argue it started in 2014. I would say it didn't get into full swing for a couple more years, but anyway, 2014 is of course when the fifth edition Player's Handbook came out, and then the latest one just came out, this year, like a couple weeks ago or whatever. And in this current era, player agency is supreme. Like, it trumps, to me it's a little bit too extreme, but like it trumps a lot of narrative beats, it trumps internal struggle to a large extent, it trumps like a lot of people, and I heard this put really well, they don't want to play, a lot of people who are getting into D&D now, or even have played it for a while, but are really, you know, simpatico with the current era, with the zeitgeist of this current gaming era, they want to be, they don't want to be struggling adventurers. They want to be protagonists.
Fantasy heroes, right? I mean, is that the fantasy?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that, do you think that's as outcome of just all of the comic movies and WoW and just like for the most part, you're a superhero?
That is a huge question. That's an excellent question. Everything you just named, you know, certainly had an influence, were certainly factors. And I'm a little embarrassed to say this, but I think because I've been like so, you know, so intent on what I've been doing for a long time, and I'm not really a creature of social media, you know, far from it. It's kind of, you know, I like literally had to get an account on X, you know, today to participate in this. And so I've kind of been just off doing my own thing, and it hasn't been until, I don't know, you know, the last 6 months or whatever, that I really started getting, you know, reading. I mean, I've been reading so much Reddit, D&D Reddit, and other game, you know, gaming stuff, mm-hmm. and all that. And I'm really seeing this, how stark the contrast is from, you know, I wouldn't have thought twice. In fact, I thought it was fascinating that you could lose control of your character. in Vampire. Yeah, you know, I love that. It's like, and it's a core feature of the game. It's like literally baked into the core humanity mechanics.
But I also think whether D&D is an escapism right now from real life, but I think you and I come from a let's explore different aspects that we could do happen in real life, but we don't currently have upon us. And so we would play these games and explore these different you know tropes or just different ways of you know flaws and merits and derangements or whatever it is that we had on our character to understand and experience that without actually doing it in real life, because sometimes that would be a little scary.
Absolutely. That's the point, that you do things that you can't do in real life. But one thing that I've noticed too, Corey, and this already came up last session, and it, you know, is like both of us play hard. Obviously, both of us want our characters to survive. We do everything we can. You know, you drive toward the mission, but it's like if the character dies, the character dies. You know, like that's the story.
It's about the story and the journey, and as far as you get in that story with that journey and that trope or whatever you're trying to, whatever aspects of that character exist, whether it's someone who has PTSD or someone that's new, that literally was born, you know, 3 months ago.
And this Edie Dandelions. Yeah.
So I just don't know if that exists right now. So the question is how do we get, I mean, you're used to a homebrew, so you got to pick and choose who you played with a lot.
Yeah, and you know, and the other thing that I see coming out in high stress situations, and I don't think this is unique to the table, is, you know, I have, you know, what, a decade and a half plus of trust and good faith built up with you in terms of being a storyteller. I'm not going to quote unquote cheat. I'm not out to get you. You know, characters have died, but like, all of it has been logical, you know. Josh pointed out in the first After Dark that I did that there were two characters died, and that actually it was, well, he didn't know about Goody Blue, so it was actually three, but you know, two characters died, and you know, during his run, that was over years, but like each of those deaths, you know, Sharn's death was like significant. And it had definitely wasn't a cheap death, you know, died fighting Robin Medici, and you guys destroyed that creature and, you know, all of that. But like, that was a pretty major thing. And then Luke dying early on and having Justin's brother die and all of that happen. That was a big deal, you know?
Yeah. It's almost impractical to say that you go through years of role playing and someone doesn't die due to whatever circumstance, you know, just again, bad roles to bad position. I mean, I just got drilled because I happened to be right in front of the train that came through that door, Morales, you know? And if I wasn't there, it could have been Wasa on the floor. Probably
Wasa would have been obliterated, actually probably dead because more of those attacks would have hit. Actually off of the rolls I can definitively say that, like, assuming I rolled the same, you know, she would have been dead because you had a significantly higher AC than she does. And you know, even as you're at death's door, the whole thing though, like the assumption is that your characters don't, like the default is that your characters don't die. That's the default. And I don't, you know, I go back and forth on this, Corey. Like I'm not saying that one way is like inherently better than the other, obviously. I'm just saying that like, we shouldn't be so precious with the characters that this is my opinion. Obviously, you know, your mileage may vary. Everybody's going to do it differently. What works for your table works for your table. For me, the characters shouldn't be so precious that the death is more important than, like, avoiding the death is more important than the story, than like telling the best story you possibly can.
And there's a difference though.
Yes.
You're coming from a tell a good story mindset versus I want to progress and just be a superhero sort of mindset, which is fine. You know, Monty Hall campaign, whatever. Right.
I mean, you know, to put it in a more generous light, that's the protagonist. That's what that person was talking about. Like, it's an interesting thing because the protagonist of a, you know, of a traditional story is like basically guaranteed to succeed, you know? And I told you, like, I thought y'all's odds at the beginning of this campaign were about 50-50. in terms of defending the dream, in terms of succeeding. Mm-hmm. It's about, some things have gone against that, some things have gone for that. You know, I won't obviously tell you as the player where I think you're on exactly right now, but there's been significant movement in both directions, honestly.
Right.
You know, the game is well in motion. That being said, that's a very, to a modern audience, like, that might be shocking that your GM says at the beginning. I'm going to say the same thing at the beginning of Curse of Strahd. Actually,
it's probably worse there.
Actually, that's Gothic horror, my friend. That's Gothic horror, and Strahd is a genius. That is a rough, as written, even. I mean, that is a wild, wild campaign. I think it's worse than 50-50 as written, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, I was joking with Randy that it was who plays Marcus on stream, that it was it was Call of Cthulhu, where you get to punch Cthulhu in the face at the end. You know, like, like, you have some reasonable expectation of beating Cthulhu in a brawl, but, like, it's basically kind of very Call of Cthulhu-y.
Yeah. I'm going to bring this back a little bit just to get a little bit more help for some of these GMs. How do you handle rules discussion and disputes, especially on stream, to maintain the flow of a story, but also give it fair consideration?
It's good. That's good. And I have been thinking about this a lot, because homebrew is different. With homebrew, for better and for worse, you have the luxury, or at least the ability, to sit and, like, really litigate something, and really explain yourself. And again, if you've been gaming with your people for any length of time, you know, I mean, rules disputes would come up every so often in our home game, but it was rare. Like, it was rare, and everybody knew that, like, they kind of know what to expect with me out of that group, you know, out of, like, you know, you and Toby and Caitlin and et cetera.
Right.
And because I wasn't playing quite as psychological, and it certainly wasn't a war story, and nobody was playing basically my version of a Dragonborn to an extent, you didn't have any beast. You didn't have anything taking the players over, really.
No, and that's your own flavor, but it's also an appropriate flavor. I mean, I think druids have some aspects of that too, especially they shape change a lot, right? Almost like werewolves, where it's like...
I mean,
They should.
And it's just elided over. It's just completely left out, you know, in the baseline game. And, you know, that's fine. Some people don't want to deal with it. Some people, you know, don't even want to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's just not a game if you ignore that kind of thing. I'm actually having to, like, bizarre as it sounds, Curse of Strahd does not have rules for feeding for the vampires. Like, it's weird. It's really weird. So it's like, it's just like, I don't know how much they have to feed and how often, you know, it's like, this is like a fundamental thing about,
but that,
know,
that economy is super important, that World Dark got right, which is feeding territories and fights over that and all that. It's economy. It's a resource.
It's huge. I mean, it's huge. It's also a way that you can smoke, that you could potentially smoke Strahd out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
No, so home games are one thing, and that is a discussion, and there, you know, there's group dynamic, there's building trust, there's setting expectations, there's all of that stuff. On stream, again, for better and for worse, like, you have to be quick about it. You have to be really quick about it. And sometimes I've gotten those rulings wrong, you know, like, by the rules, but it's like, you just have to make a decision and, like, keep moving. And then you can go back afterward and you can make sure you don't get it wrong again. Fortunately, so far, and this is very fortunate, this is dumb luck, excuse me, more than anything, is there has not yet been a ruling that I have made that has changed the outcome, you know?
Well, there might be one. I need to look this up, but I believe either Anika or during an Elishli, there was a fate point used to save someone at some point back in history. And I know this hasn't happened yet, but it may not even be necessary. But I know that last session, and it happens to be my character, you said no flat roll, no fate point, period. And I'm curious
for the players.
Oh, was that an NPC? Was that a sister? Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. That was an NPC. And see, that's what I mean. Like, it's not, it, I don't always have either the, you know, again, I'm being very real here. I don't always either have the mental agility or the time or the bandwidth when I'm juggling that much to like put that critical piece of information in. There was another one in there. There was another one in there like that. Oh, like, you know, and there is precedent for it. And I did warn people, and I have both on stream and off stream, but like, yes, I know that rules as written, you know, it doesn't matter how many people are piled onto you, but in reality, if you have 1200 pounds of human on top of you, you know, and that's not counting the gear, you're not getting back up. Like,
no, yeah.
Like you're not getting back up. And because this is fantasy, it's dark fantasy, but because it is fantasy and we are talking about heroes here who, you know, when Donnie rolled at 29 to break, I let him break all 9 grapples on him.
Right, you know? Because he had supernatural strength that was beyond human.
It was beyond human. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so I was like, okay, like even though it's really weird because there's like, again, in like as written, there's not really like even monks can't, there's not a way to simultaneously break a bunch of grapples. Like you have to deal with every single one individually, well, which is like horrible.
That leans to a lot of things in your style. So you like to ground things into reality at some level. That makes your storytelling and GMing and world different than a lot of other worlds and GMs, because that one underlying theme exists throughout how you tell stories. And so in this case, it benefited the player, and in some cases it hurt the player, but it's still consistent, which I love. And I think big thing that GMs need to think about is it's hard to do when you have you're welcome. When you don't have trust, or like you're doing these online games and you have random people come in, it's hard for them to just trust you and your rulings and then later on discuss it and things of that nature, versus, you know, trying to bring up those things during a session, especially on live stream where we really need to move forward.
It's hard. I've actually given that, you know, I know that's a whole other discussion. About online gaming, which is more and more where the hobby is going. But I will say that, I've given that a fair bit of thought, Corey, about like how I would run essentially a pickup game, where I don't have years with these people. I don't even have really like a proper, you'd really need to level set. You'd have to really level set.
And it's hard because rules lawyers want to go to the book, but we just said this a second ago, you base things on a realistic, you know, grounding, which will change some of those things.
Yeah, no, it's going to change it. And there are, now I will give, you know, fifth edition credit where credit is due. There are passages in it, particularly in the DM guide you know, they give the DM a great deal of latitude in situations. And I think there is, I couldn't quote it, but I think there is even explicitly where it says we cannot cover every situation in these rules, you know,
right.
We cannot cover every situation. So it's impossible. Even Champions, which is, you know, the most robust mechanical system I've ever run into in my entire gaming career. It's a marvel of robustness. Even it cannot cover every single, it tries, but it cannot cover every single situation. I also think, frankly, it's way too crunchy for a lot of people. They're not going to want to be doing algebra to figure out a combat round, you know, which is not an exaggeration in that. You and I both love that game, but I mean, there's a whole thing about like complexity versus verisimilitude, you know, like the finer
the juice,
grain.
The juice versus the squeeze.
Versus the squeeze, you know, the finer the grain gets, the more difficult and the more crunchy the rules tend to get. You know, there's some exceptions, but that is a pretty strong trend. I think fifth edition does a pretty good job of getting somewhere in some kind of sweet spot, and there are a lot of other cultural things like I was talking about before about the protagonist.
Yeah, kind of going along with both combat and how you run your world building and storytelling, you have a pretty interesting take. I'm not sure if it's unique about how you tell the leveling of a character leveling story, yeah. Right? Their growth story, essentially. And it doesn't happen all at once. It happens at different times for different reasons. Again, it gets back to the journey, I think, as the main base for how you like games to be run and how characters should sort of portray during those aspects.
I probably shouldn't say this as a professional GM of a Dungeons and Dragons streaming game. I don't like leveling games. Like, I don't like that. I don't like leveling as a mechanic. I really like things to be more incremental and nuanced than that.
Mm-hmm.
But once you accept the premise that these characters are going to have 19 jumps in their life, in their potential life, it's 19, no more than that. You know, that's if they hit everything, they achieve their full potential. Then as the storyteller, it's incumbent on you to make every single one of those, because that's the entire lifetime of the character, right? It's incumbent upon you, particularly if you're running 1 through 20, if you're sitting down like, hey folks, we're going all the way, you really need to think about what each of those is, because each of those is a major milestone,
right?
For those characters. And it's only going to happen that many times in their lives, which sounds like a lot, but over an entire career, that's nothing, you know?
No, that's true. And it's, by the way, I normally would have went to A&A a while ago, but since it's just Angel and I having a conversation about some of these theories and philosophy, I think, again, in the future, Angel, we would have this on the couch. We just might as well record it and have it here for other people to think about, because these are really good educational points here. You know, at least from a Dartport standpoint, when I'm curious, what is your ratio of people wanting to play more of a journey story, especially for like live stream? Like, how people want to watch like this combat and Monty Hall sort of campaign versus a story which we're trying to implement almost like a live real play Game of Thrones scenario where there is no designated outcome. Obviously, there's big moving tailwinds and headwinds and stuff, that we in motion. Go ahead.
Right, as opposed to we're fighting. I don't want to get too specific here, but as opposed to we're defeating the big bad at the end, and we all know that we're going to win at the end of the day. We're going to win,
right? To get some loot, to get some items to fight the next big bad thing. It's almost like a WoW raid, you know.
and one of us might die in the big fight to have an additional emotional impact. And let me go on, you know, go on record again by saying that the Critical Role crew, who are the titans of the space, whether they understand that, they understand it, but I don't think Matt Mercer knows that he's a historical figure. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to be the historical figure and to understand that, you know, you're making history even as you're living it. That's not easy. So it's impossible to not be compared to Critical Role. And in many minds, Corey, and I don't have data on this, but I bet you that there are more people who are watching Critical Role than are, for example, game mastering their own games. You know,
like right.
the reach of that crew is immense, and it's difficult to fully appreciate that. If you've only been a gamer during the Matt Mercer era, you know, he was integral. There were other things too, like Stranger Things and Super Avengers movies and super movies writ large. But he was just, you know, integral into introducing into the larger culture. So in that context, you're going to get compared to them, and they have a very and if not them, then Dimension 20,
right?
Which are quite different from each other. Those are quite different.
They are.
They're not the same at all. But kind of one of those two buckets. I mean, we're closer to Dimension 20, I would say, but except that their fantastically talented game master, Brandon Lee Mulligan, doesn't tend to run things for year after year after year. He's much more of the, you know, do something for a season, then we do something else. We may come back to that world, but we're going to, you know, he's all over the place. He's just this, you know, geyser of creativity. I think that for us, we are probably, and I've said this before to you privately, like we're probably actually closer to High Rollers, which is like the Critical Role of the UK. Mm-hmm. And I would say that there is, I would say that there's definitely an audience for what we're doing. Darker tone. We have a darker tone than they do. This is a war story, and it's dark fantasy both. Because mm-hmm. you can tell a war story that would, you can tell a much more happy-go-lucky war story or a much less bleak war story than what I'm telling. But we're both. But there's definitely an audience for it. I mean, there's definitely an audience for it. The responses have been, especially, I would say in the last dozen episodes, have been really strong. Certainly the last six. I mean, they've
it's a lot of groundwork that gets laid to create these characters and their mindsets and their growth. And this is changing, exactly. And we kind of went through, just because Brad Sanderson's out there, really, it's kind of like his Words of Radiance moments, the last, you know, four or five episodes, where there's been a lot of journeys and a lot of characters coming into their specialty or their area of focus, whatever one they chose. And so I think that's exciting. And people are starting to kind of put all the dots together, and things are starting to, some threads are starting to come together and make a lot of sense.
Yes. You can't see me nodding over here, but yes, the last thing I'll say is, I'm always stronger the second year, versus the first year. It just, the way that I storytell, the way that I construct, the way that I construct narratives, I don't want to even just mm-hmm. say plots, I want to say narratives. The way that I world build it's, you know, I'm not as quick, and I'm okay with that. I'm not as quick as some storytellers are. I really want to linger with the characters. I really want to get to know them and to understand them and to feel them, and to honor them, you know?
And that takes time, especially with PCs learning themselves too, right?
It takes time to get those layers in there, on both sides of the GM screen, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I'm not just saying this to like, you know, hype up Darkport. I'm genuinely excited about where the story is going to go. I mean, there are some scenes that I have in my head, you know, we'll see if they play out that way. Right. But there's going to be something there. There's going to be something there. And I really want to know what happens, you know, and to me, that's a very good thing. When you were as the GM want to know what happens next, you know,
versus the viewer. Yes. That's awesome.
Versus the viewer
and the players. You want everyone to know what's going to happen next.
It's super important. All right, Corey.
So, everyone who's listening, thanks for listening. Please, make comments about any sort of topics you want to hear about, and we'll be doing this each Friday, and hopefully, you know, we'll get people to come up and ask questions in addition to me, Angel, just talking about, you know, philosophy on gaming or some aspect. But anyways, we appreciate it, guys, and we will see you next week. And by the way, Angel starts his YouTube version of this in about 5 minutes from 7 to 8 p.m. So if you want to jump on that, and he's a little slightly different format, we would love to have you over there on YouTube.
Corey, thank you for hosting this.
Well, you're welcome. And, thanks for yeah, this is great. And we're looking forward to seeing where this goes.
Absolutely. All right, my friends.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.